What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting, filling in for Adam and Josh this week. I'm Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune.
And formerly from the AV Club, I'm Tasha Robinson. Michael Phillips.
There's a story behind that formerly. I think we'll hear that later. But anyway, Special Forces Unit, Texas Thunder. We've heard of you too, Robinson.
Why are we talking?
I have a deal for you. You receive full pardon for every criminal action you've committed in the United States. It was an accident. About an hour ago, a small jet went down inside New York City. The president was on board.
President of what?
Finding the president in the hellscape of John Carpenter's New York City. Filling in for Adam and Josh. Tough jobs. Yes, they're tough. You up for it, Tasha?
Call me Snake.
Of course. We talk tough jobs this week with our top five futuristic movie jobs, along with a review of Oblivion starring Tom Cruise.
That and more ahead on Film Spotting.
We'll get to our top five futuristic movie jobs later in the show, but first, our futuristic movie job begins right now with a review of Oblivion.
I wanted to spend the rest of my life here.
Jack? Jack? An object came down in 1-7.
Got it. On my way.
60 years ago, Earth was attacked. We won the war, but they destroyed half the planet. Everyone's been evacuated. Nothing human remains. Our job is security and drone maintenance. We're the mop-up crew.
2 more weeks, Jack, and we can leave and join the others.
Doesn't seem right. We won the war. Now we have to leave.
This is Mission Control. How y'all doing this morning?
Don't take any chances. It's dangerous down there.
That's Tom Cruise basically playing the role of Wally in the new futuristic science fiction adventure thriller drama rehash riff of every 70s movie you've ever seen called Oblivion. I'm Michael Phillips here with Tasha Robinson, and we're going to talk Oblivion now. Tasha, would you please set us up for this cockamamie thing?
Well, the basic setup of Oblivion, at least the part that we can talk about, because it is the kind of movie where if you get too far into it, somebody's going to yell at you online. Tom Cruise and Andrea Riseborough start out the film as a couple who have apparently had their memories wiped. That's stated up front in a lengthy, lengthy voiceover that lays out the world of the film. They live in a CGI glass tower that is incredibly sterile and beautiful, much like the rest of the film. And they're basically serving as high-end security guards, keeping watch over a series of giant machines that are harvesting the oceans and turning them into fuel.
And this is in the year 2077.
Yeah. You know, by then we're going to have giant ocean harvesters and, glass spires.
Righto.
So mankind has been almost entirely wiped out by a series of wars against an alien invasion force called the Scavengers, or Scavs, which sounds strangely like scabs, but that's beyond the point. And humanity is getting itself together for a move to Titan, one of the moons of Saturn. So essentially, as we begin the film, again with a really, really long voiceover setting everything up, Tom and Andrea are the only people left on the planet, as far as we know, and they're guarding the ocean harvesters with the help of a bunch of robots that look a lot like little flying baseballs with HAL 9000's eyes sunk into the middle of them. They're incredibly ominous. The whole setup is incredibly ominous. The only person that they have any kind of contact with is their controller, Melissa Leo, who, as you noted in your review, is so cheery and friendly that you can tell that something's wrong from the very, very beginning.
Right. And then the introduction of the conflict here is that when we have a manned spacecraft that crash lands on the planet, right? And then we have a discovery of a certain character that then brings this Tom Cruise character back into this question of, who is this woman I've been dreaming about? You know, if I've had my memory wiped, why am I having dreams or memories clearly of this one woman who then turns out to be a real character?
Although all of that comes after a lengthy period of time just kind of quietly exploring what's supposed to be a ravaged and shattered Earth after this alien invasion that apparently was driven away with nukes. The world seems strangely unscarred by nukes. There are craters here and there, but Tom Cruise kind of has this little paradise on Earth that he goes to hang out and think about how he doesn't really want to leave for Titan.
Right.
So there are a lot of different kind of threads and tensions going on, but it's all very low-key for quite a while, which honestly was the thing I liked most about Oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has been repeatedly compared to 70s science fiction, and I think that comes out most in that first act. Once you get back, I'm not going to stop harping on that opening voiceover because I loathed it. Every single second of Tom Cruise in that hushed, important whisper that tells us things are significant.
Yeah, I mean, I can go to public radio for that. You know, I don't need that. I don't need that with a, you know, the movie is like its own podcast for the first 10 minutes, you know.
It really is. And it becomes even more excruciating midway through the film when, as you say, a third character shows up. And they give her a good chunk of that voiceover over again, you know, just in case you weren't here for the earlier exposition. Maybe you were out getting popcorn when he started with the whispers.
Right, okay.
Maybe you missed this, so we'll explain it to you again.
Okay, so, but did you enjoy the film?
I enjoyed the film quite a bit without necessarily respecting it.
Okay, explain. I'm sorry, that's twisted for me.
Well, this is a twisty movie. It seems appropriate. There's a lot going on in this film that echoes earlier science fiction films. There's, at times, it feels like a Game of Spot the reference, where you can just sit there and say, oh, that's from Silent Running. The whole movie starts out feeling kind of Wall-E. You know, that looks a little like The Matrix. This is definitely from 2001, and on and on and on. So there's a certain feeling of watching like science fiction salad up mm-hmm, on the screen,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that bothered me a little. But it's a beautiful film. I mean, it's beautifully shot. The cinematographer, Claudia Miranda, also shot Life of Pi. And I think anybody who's seen it would agree that the visuals are the best thing about Life of Pi. I think in many ways the visuals are the best thing here.
Kind of. I enjoyed it. I sort of liked it a little bit. Not as much as you, Natasha, because I think the director, Joseph Kaczynski, whose previous film was an equally big budget picture, Tron Legacy, can you honestly say to me, I remember whole chunks of Tron Legacy, and that's how I feel about this film. I feel that it's visually sort of imposing for the second you're seeing the images, but I don't know if he's really thinking in terms of how to really pull off and sustain an action sequence or a set piece or really kind of find a look to this film other than just turning it all over to the art directors, whether they're literal art directors or the digital effects people. So is he really a good director? That's my question.
I think that there's a big question these days, and I think it's just going to keep becoming more and more pronounced, of exactly what role the director has in a film that's essentially made out of pixels. And that's certainly something that you're seeing here with, you know, there's so much artificiality on the screen. Even the actors, to some degree. I mean, Tom Cruise is not a very nuanced actor.
Right.
I think he works reasonably well here, but he's just kind of playing a variant on the, you know, the dumb, desperate, and angry guy that he played in Minority Report or that he played in the Mission Impossible films. So everything around him is artificial, that the film can't help but feel a little hollow, I think.
Do you have any memories before the mission, before the security went?
Our job is not to remember. Remember.
Do you remember her?
Cruise is such a peculiar guy because he's playing basically a regular Joe, you know, kind of a working stiff who just happens to be one of the last people left on the planet cleaning up as basically a security guard and a janitor in one. He really is Wall-E with a baseball cap, essentially.
He's more mechanic, yeah. I think, than a janitor. But yes, he's very definitely a blue-collar guy.
But to me, he doesn't. That's the thing about Cruise. And I would make exceptions for him because I think he can be a hugely effective movie star. And he's often a good actor. I don't know if you really get Cruise at his best either way in Oblivion, because there's always been something a little less than relatably regular Joe about Tom Cruise. You don't really go to Tom Cruise to get everyman. I mean, that's Tom Hanks's job, you know, or other people's. And Cruise has just got a certain kind of otherworldly intensity. He always has. And that's why there's always those great moments in the Mission Impossible films where he like runs like a maniac. And it's not really quite like human running. It's more just like Tom Cruise, and then it's running like nobody else actually runs. And that's sort of the same intensity he brings to everything he does. A film like Minority Report, though, for me, and that's another film. Look, Spielberg's Minority Report. That's referencing this and that, and it's going from a little bit of Metropolis and Things to Come, and certainly 2001. A lot of the films you just mentioned, that Oblivion's kind of riffing on. Certainly other films do that all the way. And that's kind of the story of cinema history. Popcorn movies or not, they're all taking from a dozen other pictures and hopefully pulling a fresh variation on that. I mean, all the films you've said that Oblivion is really banking heavily on. A lot of, what, you know, the average 22-year-old in the audience, have they seen Logan's Run or the Omega Man? Or anything? Probably not, right?
Let's hope they haven't seen the Omega Man.
Right. But, you know, it's how these people work with it. And I'm not sure Oblivion's really giving people enough of a story that hangs together that, to me, it's very exposition-heavy and, interestingly, kind of leisurely in that first hour. I agree with you on that. And then when it has to kind of deliver, and I hate to sound like a plebe, but, you know, when you want, you know, there are certain moments in the film where they're just set up like, okay, now it's Tom Cruise against the robots, you know, you know, that's all it is. That's for another 5 minutes. And those scenes are just okay. And that's why I'd be surprised if this film made, you know, really, really found a big audience in this country. But you, do you think it has the stuff?
Not to parrot myself in my own review, but kind of the point that I made in leading up to talking about Oblivion when I wrote about it was that that's a really common problem in science fiction films in general. Because, and the more I think about it, the more I think it's a pretty big problem in a lot of films. You kind of have your first act where you establish the characters, you establish the world, you establish hopefully why you care about these people. You establish in the second act what the stakes are and what decisions they make. But all too often, the third act of especially science fiction movies, but to some degree any movies, comes down to, you know, we've got to get the man and the woman together, or we've got to blow up the bad guy, or stop the bad guy, you know, expose the thing, have the big chase, blow up the Death Star, whatever it is. And all too often, it's that third act that the third act just has to be about action and excitement. And it really depends whether that works for you, whether the first and second acts have done their jobs and you care about the characters at all.
Yeah,
I have a pretty hard time caring too much about Tom Cruise here. What I care about is sort of the stakes of what's going to happen to everything else, not particularly what happens to him.
Hmm.
The plot demands, you know, given that we know going in that his memory has been erased and pretty much all he remembers is, I've got to be a space janitor, space mechanic, whatever it is. We know that he's a hollowed out shell of a man.
Right.
So I don't really see any particular reason to root for him or care all that much, like, in the moment. But the world itself is interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And the world itself, I think, has been well established.
This is why we go to science fiction, I think. I think we are always willing to forgive an awful lot in terms of story or rooting interests or what have you. If the world you were seeing is something really seductive. I mean, look at Avatar. You know, Avatar is the same. I mean, people would forgive that movie anything just because the minute, you know, everybody's in the air flying, that movie's place in history was cemented. It doesn't matter about anything else. I mean, none of the story concerns, none of it. But Cameron found a way to create this world. And this is why when you go back to the ones that last, I don't think Oblivion's with it, but when you look at, you know, everything from Metropolis, Things to Come, you know, even a movie that, you know, you look at something as kind of ding-dong as The Time Machine, the 1960 George Pal Time Machine. I just saw that again recently. And that's a very simple kind of almost like a young adult approach to this sort of, you know, futuristic visions, and that film has real charm, and it doesn't have great visual distinction, but it has kind of a human element that I'm not sure Oblivion is even interested in, frankly. And again, I think if you cast Tom Cruise in the middle of that, I don't even know how close you're going to get to sort of a conventional human rooting interest. He's got something else going on, and certainly in Minority Report, I think he matched the world beautifully. And although what you say about the third act issues, much as I love Minority Report, I think the audience gets considerably out ahead of the guessing games of the plot toward in that last 40 minutes. I mean, that is not particularly well plotted. I think the audience kind of knows where it's going, essentially.
In Minority Report.
And I think it's also true of Oblivion, too. As you mentioned, the Melissa Leo character, Sally, who essentially playing Hal 9000 in drag a little bit, not to give too much away, but it's you can smell it. You can smell it from the first 10 minutes of the film, kind of where certain elements are going. Now, there's some pleasure in that because it's movie going, especially with the big budget popcorn movie. It's all about not necessarily confounding expectations, but certainly just meeting them with a twist or two. And this doesn't feel like that. It doesn't, to me, it doesn't succeed.
You know, there's a lot to be said for the payoff of that kind of feeling where you know what's coming. You know more than the characters know. And that's, I mean, that goes back to Hitchcock, just the idea of, like, there's far more tension in a situation if you know something that the character doesn't know, if you know what's coming next. If you know that the bomb is under the desk, you're worried about the bomb instead of, like, listening to the characters prattle on. In the same sort of way, I think, knowing where Oblivion or Minority Report or any other movie is going can be exciting if you're waiting for the characters to catch up with you and you know that it's of critical importance that they eventually do so. Now, whether the movie works for you or not may depend on how early you get there and how dumb they are in the process of figuring it out.
Yeah, but I thought
that this was reasonably well-paced, at least until we get up to the end where I'm not going to spoil anything, but that last 10 minutes or so drags on just unconscionably.
Yeah, and that
really did bother me.
Where you don't need it to. You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Michael Phillips. I'm here with Tasha Robinson. We are filling in for Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson. And how does it feel so far? It feels, you know, like...
This seat is really comfortable. I think I'm moving in. I don't know if I'm in Adam's seat or Josh's, but it's mine now. I'm putting my name on the back of it, like director's chair style.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit more about Oblivion, and then we'll scoot on into the next film, which is not science fiction at all, but what we're talking about. If I think Tom Cruise lacks sort of the relatable every guy aspect, and that's part of what's keeping me out of Oblivion. What do you think? What's the compensation for you?
The compensation for me was largely Andrea Riseborough, who I didn't really, I think, appreciate her role in the film properly until at least halfway, maybe further through the movie.
Okay, and she plays. This is basically kind of it's a two-person job here on Tower 49, the cleanup crew. It's Tom Cruise and Andrea Riseborough. Mm-hmm. They're lovers. They're also business partners. They have 2 weeks to go, I think, before mm-hmm. they're before
yeah, it's
they.
Yeah, it's kind of a classic, one day left to retirement kind of scenario.
Right. Without Danny Glover, though.
Sadly, without Danny Glover. But they've been there 5 years, and they have just 2 weeks to go when things start falling apart.
Okay, so why do you think she's effective?
Here's the thing. As we went forward and things started to unfold and we started to get hints of what was going on, I started appreciating her role, her acting retroactively. I kind of realized that she was putting more into that role than I realized because she kind of comes across as the ice queen, as kind of placid and controlled and very surfacey in a way. But there's something, much as there's a weird little menace underlying Melissa Leo's kindness, there's a weird little anxiety underlying Riseborough's performance. And I feel like once you start finding out where that's coming from, like the reasons behind it, her performance seems more and more nuanced in retrospect until I got to the point where I was thinking this might actually play the second time through. A lot of this isn't going to play the second time through, but her performance is going to be like The Prestige, where you realize that there were layers and layers into it, that she was playing something that nobody knew was there until it was too late.
I think the anxiety in the case of her character in Oblivion is because she's, she's basically wearing Jane Jetson's outfits in heels. And this is she could be just knocking around in sweats. I mean, she's working from home, essentially, right?
She is working from
home. What's up with the dolling up?
She also has her hair rolled up on the back of her head so tightly that she is never going to need a space facelift.
So
it doesn't look comfortable at all.
So this is the opposite of Logan's Run, for example, which is my favorite hair science fiction movie from 1976, when you have Michael York and Farrah Fawcett, majors at the time, Farrah Fawcett majors, with exactly the same hair in Logan's Run. And it's all flying everywhere.
It looks so good when they're chasing runners.
Okay. Oblivion is currently out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, Tasha liked it more than I did, you can email the show at feedback@filmspotting.net or leave a voicemail 312-264-0744. You can also find the show on Twitter at Filmspotting and Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Coming up, we'll spend a few minutes on a movie that's divided critics, Derek Chian France's The Place Beyond the Pines. And I'd say that we're going to try to avoid embarrassing ourselves in Massacre Theater, but what fun would it be if we weren't embarrassed? That's next, so stay with us.
Watch out.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, filling in for Adam and Josh this week. I'm Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, and joining me until recently, film writer and editor of the AV Club, Tasha Robinson. We're going to share some thoughts in a bit on the latest film from Blue Valentine director Derek Chianfrance, The Place Beyond the Pines. But now it's time for everyone's favorite part of the show, at least that's what Adam claims every week, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, Adam and Josh massacred this movie.
Do you think it's the process itself that's a fool?
Who cares what I think? I'm not the president. I'm just a storyteller, man. That's all I am.
Well, I presume at the very least that you care something about what you sing every night.
Well, how can I answer that if you got the nerve to ask me?
You know, I'm convinced of one thing. You either do truly care about nothing at all, or tremendously much that people think so.
And you ask for my time?
Mr. Quinn, we really do need you.
Listen,
in...
I know more about you, right, than you will ever know about me. Slaughter me for all I care. I refuse to be hurt.
That was Cate Blanchett as Jude and Bruce Greenwood as Keenan Jones from 2007's I'm Not There, directed by Todd Haynes and written by Haynes and Oren Moverman. Although, Michael, it actually turns out that quite a few people guessed D.A. Pennebaker's 1967 documentary Don't Look Back, the film about Bob Dylan that Todd Haynes was actually channeling in this scene. So we're counting that as an entirely legit entry as well, at least for the purpose of bragging rights.
To hear Josh's Dylan by way of Blanchett, plus the boys' review of Terrence Malick's To the Wonder and top five Malick scenes, visit filmspotting.net or get the show via iTunes. Tasha, why don't you reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick this week's winner, won't you?
Oh, the Film Spotting hat is a Hamburg. Who knew? And the winner is Alex Lancer of College Grove, Wisconsin.
Congratulations, Alex. Email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
Now it's time for Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free. Tasha, are you ready?
Absolutely.
You start, so I'm going to give you the action and action.
Your aim is to destroy me, isn't it?
Yes.
Would you kill God?
Such vanity.
I am the sum of all these people and all their knowledge. I am all-seeing. I am everywhere and nowhere. That has often served as a definition of God. Would you destroy us and all that we are?
Yes.
Would you not rather be part of us? Joined to us? A light shining into the future? Love us. Cherish the truth.
No.
You have penetrated me. There is no escape.
And
scene.
That was the most petulant little flibbertigibbet version of that character.
Well, what exactly were you doing?
I was doing a generic all-purpose guy with a low voice.
You were doing your Cookie Monster in a metal band imitation there.
I always pull that out. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location. Because we, you know, unless it's an undisclosed location, your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Deadline is Monday, April 29th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Had some family problems.
You've got family problems. I've got family problems too. But you know what? I still come to work every day on time.
What are we talking about here? I got drunk once, but since I've been here, I have been really good. I have been on time, all my appointments, all my meetings, everything. Ask Mitch!
That was Tilda Swinton as Julia from Eric Zonka's 2008 film Julia. It's a fantastic movie, and I'm given to understand that it played at Ebertfest this year, which you attended. Michael, how was that?
I didn't see the whole thing this year, Tasha, but I've been to 5 of the last 6 Ebertfests done in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. This was Roger Ebert's, you know, annual film festival of overlooked or just films simply he liked. And of course, this year it was a hugely emotional experience because Roger had passed earlier this month at the age of 70. And after a heavy week of 3, you know, variously sized and scaled memorial services for Roger here in town, To go down to Champaign and hang out at the Virginia Theater, this fantastic single screen, recently restored theater. It's truly one of the best places to see a movie in the Midwest. It's got a lot of the charm of something like the Music Box Theater here in Chicago, but it's a different kind of spatial experience, the Virginia Theater. But it was a wonderful way to just remember and just to kind of spend time with Roger's film taste, because these are films, you know, all kinds of things. Richard Linklater's Bernie was there. I introduced and did a Q&A for the film Oslo, August 31st, a fantastic film from the co-writer, director Joachim Trier, who came in from Oslo in terrible weather. I mean, all these people were flying into either Chicago or all the way down to Champaign-Urbana. Some made it and some didn't. Jack Black was going to come in for Bernie, and, you know, he got kind of weathered out, and they ended up just sort of Skyping in a phone call and doing a Q&A with Richard Linklater, who did make it up from Austin. Anyway, it's a great experience. I only got to do one day, but some of the film spotting pals like Dana Stevens was there, Matt Singer came in, and it was a really warm kind of remembrance of Roger. Every film turned into that, and it was so, like a lot of things Ebert did when he was alive. It's a one of a kind event. It's not the normal run of things to have a film critic establish his or her own film festival and then bring in all these various writers, directors, Oscar winners. You know, the head of Sony Pictures Classics, Michael Barker, who was an old friend of Roger's. The whole thing was this sort of wonderful stew. It always is. And I really do hope they find a way to keep it going, because I'm to sit and watch new films, old films, like the festival opened with Days of Heaven, a really good print, apparently, of Malick's Days of Heaven. It's a 65-foot screen. It's just a big, great, immersive movie-going experience. And to see 900 people really fall headlong into movies as disparate as Bernie, Linklater's Bernie, and Joachim Trier's Oslo, August 31st, and then have, you know, good Q&As afterwards, and then you just sort of spill out onto the sidewalk and keep the conversation going. And it's just one of those film festivals where there are no decisions to be made. You make no decisions at Eberfest. There's not, oh, do I see this film at 2 o'clock or do I see that one? It is simply just go to this, go to that, go to that, eat, drink, talk. It's, you know, it's great. It was a great experience.
You know, there's been just such a love poured out for Roger Ebert since his passing. It seems like everybody's telling their stories, and all of those stories kind of amount to, he got me into film, he got me into criticism, he got me into film criticism, like one or all of those. Even on Film Spotting, Adam and Josh had pretty much the same thing to say, just about how critical he was to their growth as critics and to, you know, them entering the field and developing their tastes. So the fact that there was at least still like one more opportunity for him to share his taste with the world and to get people into these all of the films that you're talking about are films that I've seen and loved, and the idea of, you know, bringing them forth to a new group of people who maybe hasn't seen them, I can't think of a better way to memorialize him.
I gotta say, I saw Bernie, Linklater's Bernie, and Richard Linklater is really one of the few American filmmakers working steadily today where every film is worth wrestling with. I mean, I like some more than others. I've never seen a dismissible Richard Linklater film. And Bernie, I liked. I saw it. This is one film I remember. I seeing it at the Lake Street screening room in the Loop, downtown Chicago. Probably, you know, maybe six or eight people. Some laughter in this small audience, you know, enjoyed it. But a relatively quiet, muted experience. And, you know, I had my experience of the film that way. Then, to see it down there last weekend with 900 people, and not like horse laugh, idiot laughter, but just really really in sync with the sense of humor of the film. It became a different experience.
I can understand chewing each bite of some food 25 times like chicken fried steak, but I don't think you have to chew your refried beans that many times. It doesn't really make sense. It's unnecessary additional work for your jaws. Think of your poor TMJ muscle. It couldn't be good for it. It's inefficient. Think about it. You know this drives me crazy. Please stop. This is like nails on a chalkboard to me. Okay, go ahead. Chew like that. Chew like that all day.
And this is, it's the most obvious thing in the world, Tasha, but just another reminder that when you get a good movie experience with a crowd of hundreds and hundreds of people, it is not like anything else. And I hope it doesn't go away. I really don't. That's why I never spend any money on any electronics for the house, because I want to go out.
Okay. Well, there really is nothing like appreciating something that you love, like simultaneously with a huge crowd of people appreciating the same thing.
You're here.
He's yours.
You're not gonna tell me?
He just took off. How are you gonna take care of him?
You wanna provide for that kid? Do that using your skill set.
I can't think of another line of work that I'd rather be in.
Hey! Get down!
Everybody wants to live, put your hands in the air!
105 in pursuit of suspect.
That was the trailer from The Place Beyond the Pines, Derek Chianfrance's follow-up to 2010's Blue Valentine, once again starring Ryan Gosling. Michael, you want to set us up for this one? What is this film about?
Yeah, well, it's about, I mean, broadly speaking, it's about fathers and sons and moral compromise and, you know, just how kind of the legacy. It's a lot of, like, classically American themes, just about how, you know, the sins of the father kind of are passed on to the son. And, you know, I have to say, I went in resisting this, partly just because in the description it sounded kind of hokey and melodramatic. But Gosling plays a motorcycle stunt performer who's traveling this sort of back roads with this two big carnival. And he comes through Schenectady, New York on an annual trip. And he learns that he's fathered a son with a local waitress played by Eva Mendes. And she's now living with somebody else. And Luke wants to establish some sort of connection, if not with her so much, but at least with this infant son. He turns to bank robbery to kind of make this happen at the behest of his pal, played by Ben Mendelsohn. And for a while, he actually is a ferociously effective bank robber and getaway driver because he's such a good cyclist. And then for reasons that you don't want to necessarily get into plot spoilers heavy, but the focus of the story shifts rather suddenly to a police officer played by Bradley Cooper, who has a brief intersection with the life of the Gosling character. And Cooper's life is changed forever the day he becomes kind of the hero who caught the so-called moto bandit. And then it becomes an entirely different film, really, for the middle third about Cooper's travails. And then you have this fantastic thing at the end. And I don't think this is a spoiler to talk about it this way.
Fantastic.
Yeah. No,
you may come to blows over this one.
Where you have, there's a title card you don't see very often in the movies at the two-thirds point where it says 15 years later. And then, bam, you get a whole new set of characters, which are basically the offspring of the characters we've already seen, following up in a very kind of novelistic way what we've already seen set into motion by this story. It's a very leisurely and sort of daring structure because it covers so much ground.
It does cover a lot of ground. But, you know, I have to say, you don't see that kind of title very often, but when I do, I dread it. And part of that is because you know you're going to be skipping over a lot of material, a lot of pretty crucial development. And for a film that follows its characters as closely and as intimately and as leisurely as this film does, to suddenly like leap forward in time and gloss over so much important stuff, I found it very problematic.
No, it did not play that way to me. It did not. It just simply was. You would not think twice about accepting that if it was a novel, Tasha. I really believe that.
Absolutely.
You would just like, okay, I accept it. And that's in this film, I think for me, Stephen Francis' film is quite a big step up for me from his previous one, Blue Valentine, which I thought was worth seeing only for Michelle Williams and despite Ryan Gosling, because there's something about Gosling's in Blue Valentine, where he plays this sort of flawed but sympathetic character who's just trying to get his life together and keep his marriage and his family intact, whenever Gosling sort of gets going in an improvisational riff, to me it just looks like an acting exercise working itself out. Michelle Williams does the same thing, I believe, every second of it because she's so emotionally true. And that's why, you know, in addition to kind of the description of Place Beyond the Pines, I thought, ugh, Gosling again, you know. But he is, like Bradley Cooper, these are somewhat limited actors who, when they get the right material and they're working with the right directors, they really do kind of get beneath The potential contrivances of the characters or even the story, and they get to play enough honest moments where they kind of the acting goes away. And I think a lot of the secret to really effective screen acting is, and David Fincher would certainly argue this, is to essentially, with some people, beat the acting out of the performance.
Well, that was a very Stanley Kubrick thing, too. Just run them through it over and over and over until they're so exhausted that
okay,
they just
but,
say
but,
the
but,
lines.
But Kubrick ends up turning the people into gargoyles. I mean, he's not interested in, you know, easygoing, naturalistic sort of truth, honesty. Mm-hmm. It's more about the inhuman glower. You know, you think of Sterling Hayden from Strangelove or everybody. I mean, it's all over YouTube. People have done these sort of clip reels of, you know, the Stanley Kubrick glower. And it's also in Room 237, I think, where, like, there's a string of clips from Kubrick's, everybody kind of giving that sort of inhuman, demonic stare, unblinking stare from Vincent D'Onofrio.
It's just exhaustion. It's just exhaustion. Complete and utter exhaustion.
But I think
Ryan Gosling looks exhausted all the time too.
Exhausted.
But it's a very different thing.
It's good, and I think this film, again, I think Bradley Cooper and Ryan Gosling both are, and I've said this about other people, they're slightly luckier than they are talented, and they might actually even acknowledge this. A lot of actors are. But I think if they continue to work with the right people and on the right projects in and among the Hangovers and the rest of it, they really actually will become better and better actors. And I think that's why Place Beyond the Pines does work, because you have a setup where there is no real strong hero or villain anywhere in this story. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, that was refreshing as hell.
Well, you're defending this movie really hard, Michael, but you're not actually defending the third act at all. You're talking about the actors and the direction and the setup in the first two acts.
Well, I don't want to give the whole thing away, but you're picking up, there's no question the contrivances are there in The Place Beyond the Pines, where you have, in the third act, you have, I'll try to do this without dancing around it too much. You have two teenage characters who are the offspring of the two leads played by Cooper and Gosling, and they have their own maybe improbable but, you know, sort of dramatically effective intersection at a dramatic moment.
Sure, and it's heavily implied that everything about their relationship comes out of what happened between their fathers.
Yeah.
Especially when they start to find out what happened between their fathers.
Yeah, and I bought it. I liked it.
Where are you from?
Troy.
Troy?
Yeah, you heard of Troy?
Yeah, I've heard of Troy.
Where's Troy at?
Right next door, dude.
Right next door?
I would have guessed you were from Long Island.
Where's that?
It's where people that talk like you come from.
I'm bored as a motherfucker here, dude. I've been here for like 3 days. I'm bored out of here. Mine.
Welcome to Schenectady.
What you do is do for fun. Nothing? This is it. This is what I got for a year.
No, we got some things.
What? Don't say like a mall. If you say mall, me, I swear to God.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you said earlier that I would buy it if this was a novel, and I would agree with you on that. I mean, I am a sucker for generational stories. Pretty much any time a story tries to tell that kind of ambitious story about how the decisions that one generation makes affect, if not necessarily shape, the decisions of the next generation, I'm caught up in that. I mean, I think that's just an inherently ambitious structure, and it's an inherently interesting one. Mm. And you know who does it really well in novels is Margaret Atwood. There's an awful lot of that in her stories. And I like the concept here. I just didn't care for the execution as much. Mm. Because to me, the third act was not nearly as well developed as the first two acts. And I ended up not really seeing these two boys in the third act as characters in and of themselves. I kept seeing echoes of their fathers. Now, the first two acts, basically the Ryan Gosling act and the Bradley Cooper act, each one of them gets pretty deep into its character's psyche, mm-hmm. into his relationship with other people, into what he wants, into what he can't have and why. The stakes are much higher. When we get into that third act, all of a sudden, we're just kind of echoing around in a kind of an echo chamber. And I found myself wondering, is the point of all this to say that, you know, an awful lot of their differences have to do with the class differences? are we saying that your class is destiny? Are we saying that your parents are destiny, your parentage, your DNA, like the situation you come out of? What is the point of all of this?
But do you really want to be told what the point is?
I don't necessarily want a message, but I want some idea that the filmmaker knows what he's saying. Like, what exactly is he trying to communicate about the relationship between these two boys and their fathers? And I ended up not really knowing, maybe because we're trying to concentrate on two people at once and the relationship between them. I wound up not knowing either of them. I felt half as well as I knew their dads. And as a result, I wanted to know what happened to their
dads. I don't think you can. You'd have to have a fourth act if you were going to get that kind of detail. What you have is just sort of this sense of dread, this impending doom about, oh my God, you know, these boys are going to be put through some sort of ringer dramatically that is a direct result of the relationships of the fathers before them. We know what's happening there. I agree. It's more of a coda than a fully developed.
It's a long coda. I wouldn't have a problem with a fourth act. I was talking about this with Nathan Rabin, a colleague of mine, and we basically both kind of agreed that it either needed to be half an hour longer or 20 minutes shorter.
No, I disagree. Because what is it? It's like 146 minutes or something like that?
It's 2 hours and 20 minutes
long. But to me, that's just right. And there's something about, even though it's a little schematic, there's something about the messiness of this film I just vastly prefer to the previous one, Blue Valentine. I just think I never got that feeling like any of it's just sort of showcase for the actors or acting exercises being sort of padded out to full.
It's a much more open story.
Yeah.
I mean, instead of having that claustrophobic, suffocating feel of these two people just tearing at each other over and over,
right,
you get a much bigger sense of the larger world. And some of that larger world is a lot of fun. At the point where Ray Liotta shows up, he doesn't even have to say anything for you to know who he is, what he's there for, and what's wrong.
Yeah, as a local policeman who's, guess what, corrupt, you know, the casting's almost a little too on the nose.
It might be a little too on the nose, but that lets the director keep his role fairly small and telegraphic.
Yeah, and you know, good. He's subtle.
He is.
I mean, he's not acting very hard. It's actually, you can tell. I'm guessing that a lot of the communication with the director, Jean France, and his actors are just, oh, okay, good. Just, you don't have to kill it. You don't have to kill it, you know.
Just be there and be Ray Liotta.
There's something, you know the critic and film historian David Thompson, mm-hmm, who wrote the Big Screen, I think was the name of this most recent book. Fantastic. And he thinks that's the film of the year. He thinks The Place Beyond the Pines is, I'll just quote from a piece he wrote in the New Republic. He says, if there are better films this year, then we are in luck. If it opened in December, this film would seem a major event. So this is kind of the question, in March and April, do we just sort of have this shruggy feeling of like, yeah, they're dumping it no matter what it is? I don't know. But the film got a respectful but not great reception when it was playing the festival circuit. So there is something about The Place Beyond the Pines that a lot of people, smart people, are resisting from fully and going, I don't know. I didn't see it. I just, for once, I jumped over the hurdle and felt like, okay, great. The mess and all. There's something unruly and truthful about this story of fathers and sons, which is the oldest theme in American literature and American film.
To me, it didn't feel consistently unruly, though. I think that first act with Ryan Gosling is very unruly. It's very sprawling. It's intimate and spacious at the same time, and I enjoyed it a lot. Then when you get into the Bradley Cooper segment, it becomes much tighter. Like, the whole story becomes tighter and more focused and more directional as he ends up caught up in this situation that he has.
Well, it's more claustrophobic, right?
But he has this, he's in a situation that he has no control over, and it seems for a while like he has no escape from. Then with the third act, we kind of go back to that, you know, loosey-goosey kind of handheld feel, both with camera work and with the story. And suddenly it's very much echoing the first act, but it echoes in it in a way that just doesn't seem as strong to me.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I mean, you got excited when you saw that 15 years later title card. I immediately thought of Enchaîne on Delu. And I think it's 27 years later.
Right.
And they're doing the exact same thing they were doing before the title. And it's kind of a surrealistic joke.
Right.
But I had that kind of that same feeling. It felt almost surreal to cut the story at that point, leave so much in the dirt, leave so much behind, rush forward into this future where suddenly I don't recognize anybody. I don't recognize, and I don't mean just in terms of not knowing the characters. I mean in terms of, you know, the whole world has changed in ways that we can't track and never quite get a hold of
in
that story.
It's no question, it's a little audacious. And yeah, it works for some and not others, but I wish more movies took those kind of leaps.
Well, I don't want to sell it short at all. I think it's a fascinating film. I was completely absorbed in it. I think it's full of tremendous performances. Although I'll tell you what, in some ways, I think it does have a fourth act. That fourth act is the movie Drive, also with Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, which I can't stand.
But you could very easily read the way the film ends as leading either into the beginning of Drive. Like, it could be a prequel to Drive.
Maybe.
If his character goes forward. Or this could be the sequel to Drive. This could be what happened to Ryan Gosling.
I like it. I shouldn't say I can't stand it. I think it's well made, but I think it's also kind of reprehensible. The Place Beyond the Pines is currently out now in limited release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email the show at feedback@filmspotting.net.
The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Midnight in the village, see the lights of candles from bitter end to gaslight. Bias leaves the stage. Oaks takes notes when the black and guitar burn together all in rage. You've got what it takes. You say too much. Van Ronk says to Bobby, she's the next real thing. Crowds in the hail flight, screaming like a banshee. You're in the boat, babe, we're in the water.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Filling in for Adam and Josh this week, I'm Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Joining me, the AV Club's Tasha Robinson.
And now we're going to do our top five for the week. We came up with the theme of top five movies about future jobs. The idea here being that we were spinning off of Oblivion, where Tom Cruise plays a sort of future post-apocalyptic security guard slash mechanic slash janitor, whatever you want to call
it. Like a mall cop, yeah.
So these are movies in which people have jobs that would only exist in the future.
Tasha, before we get to your number five top five futuristic movie job, now just explain to me, are these jobs in the movies cool jobs? I mean, are these?
No way. There is nothing on my list that is a job that I would necessarily want to have. I mean, some of these people are fairly cool people. At least one of them is not a people at all. But none of these are jobs that I personally would envy. It's definitely not. This is not our list of top five awesome future jobs that we totally can't wait to have.
Good. So what's your number five?
Well, you know, it's kind of tradition here with Film Spotting to put some parameters on yourself to limit things. My original list was much longer and much different. When I put the rules on myself that I was only going to deal with jobs that only existed in the future, I ruled out such things as space sheriff in Outland, a space marine in Alien 2, space truckers in Alien. You know, that movie is kind of credited with the idea of the space trucker, the working Joe in space, just working a regular job.
Right.
And essentially, the people in that job, they definitely have an unenviable future job, but it really is just kind of, you know, driving a big truck of fuel from one place to the other. So I ruled it out as not different enough, even though it takes space. I actually ruled out 2001 for myself because the role in that came to my mind was your space flight attendant who's responsible for taking your pen out of space and sticking it back into your pocket.
I like the one-to-one customer attendant ratio in that, so, you know, in flights. It's not really like that flying commercially in the
U.S. Not so much, but, you know, there are fewer people on space planes. My number five is Strange Days, the Kathryn Bigelow movie in which it takes place in the future where a sort of brain net has been invented that can store and restore memories. They're illegal, and Ralph Fiennes plays a character who's basically a drug dealer, except instead of drugs, he's dealing in memories. He sets people up with these like illegal little sort of hairnet things, which lets them experience short clips of life as other people. And he's dealing in, you know, black memories, as they call them, you know, memories of first-person experiences of people dying or touching themselves inappropriately in ways that I'm sure Kathryn Bigelow is not attempting to encourage in any way. But essentially, he's a drug dealer in a drug that doesn't exist yet, the drug of experience.
This is not like TV, only better. This is life. It's a piece of somebody's life. It's pure and uncut. It's straight from the cerebral cortex. I mean, you're there, you're doing it, you're seeing it, you're hearing it, you're feeling it.
What kind of things, exactly?
Exactly anything. It's whatever you want, whoever you want to be, okay? I mean, you want to go skiing without leaving your den, you can. But I'm assuming that a guy like you, you want to go skiing, you fly to Aspen. That's not what you're interested in here. It's about the stuff that you can't have, right? The forbidden fruit, Like running into a liquor store with a .357 Magnum in your hand, feeling the adrenaline pumping through your veins, huh?
It's a really flashy movie. It's very immersive. It creates this rather depressing vision of the future that's still just fascinating and absorbing for me. But one of the things that sticks with me more than anything is the idea of Ralph Fiennes essentially finding a niche in the world that doesn't exist yet and exploiting it in a way that's kind of destroying him and not necessarily good for the people he deals with either. But it's just, you know, inherently fascinating.
Good pick, Tasha. And in this film, Strange Days falls into a category of futuristic movies I happen to like a lot, in that they're set in the near future, but we've now blown past that year, in that Strange Days was set in 1999. So you get to see just how bad it was supposed to have gotten by then in terms of depravity and just kind of the moral sinkhole of the near future, this dystopian view. But, you know, my number five, in fact, is Escape from New York, a film made in the early 80s, set in 1997, when New York is a maximum security prison and breaking out is impossible and breaking in is insane, as the ads used to say. And my favorite, the great job in that is Snake Plissken, of course, who we've referenced in the show already, played by Kurt Russell, a convicted bank robber who is unloosed to go retrieve the president whose airplane, Air Force One, has been downed on the island of Manhattan. And essentially, Snake Plissken is an exfiltration expert, much like the Ben Affleck character in Argo. He's just a little less, you know, wholesome.
You live here.
Skulls? Are you kidding? I'm with the Turks now. I just got caught on the street after dark, and I'm stuck here all night.
Plane crashed 7 hours ago near 8th Avenue. Did you see it?
No.
Shit.
You're a cop.
Asshole.
Exfiltration expert, as played by Kurt Russell, with an eye patch, and you get to hang around a little bit with Harry Dean Stanton and Adrian Barbeau and Isaac Hayes and Ernie Borgnine, who really, even by Ernie Borgnine standards, is mugging his hiney off in Escape from New York. But that's my number five.
That's a really fun movie. And, you know, it was kind of from Kurt Russell's golden period, where all of his movies were kind of sloppy, insane fun. I'm going to go straight into my number four, which just came out last year. It's Rian Johnson's Looper, with Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a looper. This is a job that doesn't exist right now because we don't have time travel yet. He is essentially assigned the task of killing people who are shoved backwards in time through a time portal by some sort of shady future crime syndicate, the understanding being that eventually the last person that he kills, the last person to be shoved through the hole, will be his own future self, thus closing the loop.
So do you know what's going to happen? You done all this already? As me?
I don't want to talk about time travel. Because if we start talking about it, then we're going to be here all day talking about it, making diagrams with straws.
We both know how this has to go down. I can't let you walk away from this diner alive. This is my life now. I earned it. You had yours already. So why don't you do what old men do and die?
Why don't you just take your little gun out between your legs and do it, boy?
The film goes on from there, and it gets far more complicated and far more interesting. But one of the things interesting about science fiction is the way an invented technology affects the society and sort of rolls forward into other aspects of the society. This is a pretty clear case of something as simple slash wacky as time travel being invented rolls out into this entire new form of crime and this entire new form of jobs.
Time travel is the most durable of all science fiction concepts, honestly.
It's pretty durable.
Irresistible. My number four is a slightly older film, Fritz Lang's Metropolis. And I'm afraid, Tasha, that for my futuristic movie job, I made it up. Because what I'd love to be is I'd love to be the nightclub columnist in the world of the Metropolis. Because those nightclub scenes at these depraved sort of Weimar era Berlin visions of the future. It's a dystopian, you know, futuristic society, but really what you're getting is mid-1920s Berlin, you know, depravity and this Art Deco craziness in the nightclub scenes. I would just love to have been a nightclub columnist, kind of like Rick Kogan, you know, like covering the scene in this in Chicago in the 70s, you know, covering these nightclubs. So my number four, I'm afraid, Tasha, is a completely invented conceit that wasn't even in the movie. But I love Metropolis. And if I had actually picked somebody who had a great and a really necessary futuristic job in Metropolis, it would be the woman who foments the revolution to kind of fight back the city overlords and just, you know, take care of the huddled masses yearning to get out of the underground. And what is it about dystopian futures, Tasha, where they always burrow underground? I mean, you look at, you know, everything H.G. Wells wrote practically and then was later filmed. You know, even movies as crazy as that 70s dystopian film, A Boy and His Dog. It's always underground. It's always underground.
You get your latter Matrix movies.
That's right. It's under. But anyway, Metropolis is one of those great movie finds that keeps yielding new material. They just found more additional material that they had considered lost forever in a vault down in South America. And so more and more, you know, every 10 years or so, it seems that a few extra pieces of Fritz Lang's crazy futuristic vision get added to the most recent complete version of Metropolis, so that by now it's really become a kind of artifact that just keeps kind of getting a little bigger and a little bigger. The movie is just insanely naive and dystopian craziness, but it just is dynamic cinema. It's great. It's great.
I think you're making an argument that time travel does exist and that the film custodians of the future just keep going back in time to demand that Fritz Lang shoot more and more and more of this film. And eventually it's going to be 5 or 6 hours long. We're just going to keep stretching it outward from
it'll,
there.
It'll keep pace with The Place Beyond the Pines that way then.
And eventually, once they finally stop shooting more and more of it, maybe it'll have your, you know, nightclub Art Deco reporter slash, maybe you'll be in that role yourself.
Who knows?
If you get a hold of the time travel device, you could go back and star in that film.
That's right. You're listening to Tasha Robinson and me, Michael Phillips. We are guest hosting Film Spotting, filling in for Adam and Josh. And we are plowing our way through the top five futuristic movie jobs that we may not necessarily want these jobs.
But
what's your number three?
My number three is WALL-E, the Pixar movie about a tiny robot. You could make an argument that WALL-E's job is a job that does actually exist during this time period, which actually we didn't talk much about how he derived these films. But one of my rules was only jobs that exist in the future, no jobs that exist in our time. We'll talk about a little bit about that, I think, when we get to our runners-up. So you could argue that WALL-E's job is a trash compactor and that already exists in this day and time. I'm going to make the argument that his job is essentially to clean up the entire Earth, you know, to clean up a unbelievably vast amount of trash that's been produced in roughly our day and age. And, you know, his future job is kind of to prepare the world for being livable again. You've kind of got him and his sad, eternal, lonely little job, which is the fascinating thing about that film is just that lengthy, wordless opening sequence where you get to see exactly how he does his job. So much of that opening is focused on the procedure, the day-to-day like life of a tiny little robot trying to clean up the entire Earth by himself. But then if you want to argue that that's too much of a job that exists now, not enough of a job that exists in the future, you could also say that Eve, the next robot that comes along and finds him, and they begin a strange little robot romance, is kind of a environmental condition checker, which I'm pretty sure is a job that doesn't quite exist, at least not in the sense of find a plant, stick it in your stomach, and fly home.
She's got the soul of middle management, though, which is why it took me a long time for me to warm up to her.
Did you not like that?
Oh, no, I adore the film. I love that film. And I think the first 45 minutes is a real masterwork. And I think it's now, you know, we're not really in Pixar's amazing streak anymore, but there were three or four films there. WALL-E, Ratatouille, Up. I'm forgetting one, I think. But
for me, The Incredibles was on that list. That's still one of my favorite films.
Yeah, but I'd go a tick lower on that. But, I mean, those three, it's just some of the best American movie making of the last couple decades.
And, you know, one of the things about making movies that strong and getting that kind of universal praise is I think that it invigorated them, it energized them, and it let them feel free to do something as, you know, remarkable and startling as that first 45 minutes.
Exactly. You know, and everybody thought, well, is this too dark? It's to this, it's to that. You know, it's simple, plaintive, beautiful storytelling. And it's not, it doesn't feel pummeling. And so much, quote, kids' entertainment has a very kind of pummeling, hammering quality. And I'm sorry, but that's, I just didn't get that in any of WALL-E.
Not at all. Not a job I'd want. How about you? What's your number three?
My number three is a job I really would want just because of the jetpacks. Any cop in Minority Report. I love the jetpack scene. I love the fact that the scene where the cop portrayed by Tom Cruise, John Anderton, is trying to be apprehended by his former fellow colleagues on the D.C. police force in the year 2054. In the original script, apparently, there was no such action sequence involving these hover packs or jetpacks, but Spielberg simply said, Steven Spielberg, the director, said, you know, jetpacks. And so there you go.
It's the future. Where's my flying jetpack?
And it's fantastic. And this is what you say when you talk about, you know, plausible technology pulled off in a way that isn't just, you know, mind-blowingly, unbelievably futuristic. It's more just like, yes, in 40 years, you could see it happening. And the way that action scene is pulled off, none of it feels implausible. And it's all kind of witty and exciting, and it's just really great. And I'd love to be a cop with a jetpack, you know? I'd love to be a janitor with a jetpack, you know?
There's a lot of really unpleasant dystopian aspects to the plausible technology in that film, one of them being the ads that follow you wherever you go. I'm glad that I do not have the future job of programming ads to address you by name.
I love that. Hey, you look like you can use a Guinness. You know, I love those.
You should come
over
here. I'm looking at your shirt. You should come over and buy three more just like it. That and the little robot spiders that the cops use to identify people.
Excellent. Yeah.
It's a really, really plausible use of really frightening technology.
No, it's great. I think that film gets better every year. But now you're number two in top five futuristic movie jobs. Please.
My number two is the job of fireman in Fahrenheit 451. I know that this film is dismissed in some circles as unworthy Truffaut, as lesser Truffaut. I really love this film, and it's partially because I love the story so much. It's just such a fascinating look at essentially a future where firemen are people who come to your house and burn all your books because books are full of ideas and ideas are controversial and dangerous. They make people unhappy because they make people think. They make people disagree with each other. So you have this very shiny and in some ways seemingly utopian future where everybody has what they want, but slightly scratch the surface and you find a place where nobody really has what they want. And it's in part because they're not allowed to think for themselves. They're not allowed to process their own emotions in any way, shape, or form. It's a really chilly movie. It's a really frightening movie, especially once you just start to like dig into the way that human nature does kind of push in that direction of, wouldn't it be better if we could all get along? Wouldn't it be better if at least all the people who disagree with me were made to shut up and go away?
Books are just so much rubbish. They have no interest.
Then why do some people still read them, although it's so dangerous?
Precisely because it is forbidden.
Why is it forbidden?
Because it made people unhappy.
Do you really believe that?
Oh, yes. Books disturb people. They make them antisocial.
I haven't seen that film in a long time. I remember really liking Bernard Herrmann's score to that, too.
Bernard Herrmann is just a winner all the way around.
Yeah. No, I've got to check that out. My number two is... I'm afraid of the biggest cliche imaginable in terms of any futuristic anything. It's Hell 9000 and 2001. I just love...
Wait. You want the job of killing humanity?
Well, I want the job of... with the option to kill humanity. I don't know if I would actually do it. But I admire Hal in many ways. I think he's a guy who knows how to keep a rein on his emotions, you know, which I wish I had more bosses like that.
I'm getting scared and I want out of this room.
I think what I'm honestly remembering, Tasha, is the effect that character, Hal, and that movie had on me at the age of 8. To see 2001, A Space Odyssey, at the age of 8, I might have been 9. It was 8 or 9. And Hal, I think the moment where he just really just says, you know, where he starts digging in a little bit, it's like, I don't think I'm going to do that, Dave.
That's one of the all-time classic film lines.
It's, you know, Kubrick, he's a god to me in some ways. And in other ways, I think 2001 ended his truly greatest streak. I think his great films, I've probably said it on Film Spotting in the past, but his truly great films would span 56 to 68, from The Killing up through 2001. I don't have nearly the same respect or admiration or anything for things like Clockwork Orange. Maybe in another 10 years I'll revisit that, but
yeah, you're not going to get an agreement from me on Clockwork Orange. That came fairly close to that's another film set in the quote-unquote far future that I did actually consider for this list in terms of programmer, essentially. The people who program Malcolm McDowell into the state of being a Clockwork Orange, that's one of my favorite films.
No, it isn't.
No, it's not.
No,
I didn't realize.
We're going to run a retraction on the website. I'm sorry. It's not good enough.
You can box me for it later.
Okay. And you're number one here in the top five futuristic movie jobs. Please, Tasha, what is it?
Well, it's funny that you said that 2001 and Hal was the biggest science fiction cliche, because I kind of feel like my number one is the biggest cliche that could possibly be on this list. It's Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. I don't think you're going to get a more distinctly futuristic job.
So this explains why you've been doing the origami the whole taping.
It's
here.
Like 14 unicorns just sitting here in front of me. Am I not?
I don't know.
Who knows?
It's a big call I have to ask. Yeah.
I don't think you can get a more futuristic job than the guy who is essentially responsible for running down and killing rogue androids, clones, a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. However you explain replicants, you've basically got Harrison Ford as a bounty hunter whose sole job is to run down these superhuman machines. You've got a little bit of Logan's Run there with the idea that somebody is essentially responsible for taking down the people who refuse to fit into their slot, refuse to fit into the role that's been assigned to them. But it is certainly a very futuristic movie. Again, like so many of these choices, very chilly, very antiseptic in some ways. It's a very, very cold version of the future, but it's beautifully executed in the director's cut. That's a favorite movie of mine, and I don't see how it could not end up on this list.
Excellent. My number one is a film I actually haven't made up my mind on, or I seem to be changing a little bit over the years on Steven Spielberg's AI. But it is my among the top five futuristic movie jobs. I really just this is a job I think in some ways, if I were a mecha, I think it would be cool to be Gigolo Joe, as played by Jude Law, just because he's taking care of people's needs. He's also taking care of the young protagonist's journey, accompanying him on this journey through this very, very dark journey into his destiny in the future. I also love it because it, just like 2001 will always remind me of the 8-year-old me, a film like AI and other films kind of reminds me of the 13-year-old pimply me. There's a great tradition in movie science fiction, like you say, Rod Taylor's character in this cheeseball thing from the 50s, World Without End, Rod Taylor and the Time Machine. You have a long line of these virile characters who are basically showing up in the plot to save the human race from, the men have become these sort of emasculated, pasty guys who need, more time in the sun and just kind of need a little more testosterone. And then along comes a guy like Gigolo Joe to kind of write things, or Rod Taylor in World Without End or any of that. So it's really more just like, self-aggrandizing notion of like saving humanity through lots of casual sexual encounters.
I know women. They sometimes ask for me by name. I know all about women. About as much as there is to know. No two are ever alike. And after they've met me, no two are ever the same. And I know where most of them can be found.
Where?
Rouge City. Across the Delaware. Too far for our feet. We'll need help to get there.
Jude Law, he's such a chipper character. He's such a cheerful presence in that movie. In some ways, a dark and ugly, depressing future where even something as ostensibly sweet as Haley Joel Osment as a robot child can just have a really dark, unpleasant edge to it.
So sinister, yeah. And, I really resisted AI the first time I saw it almost completely. It seemed like a complete compromise of sensibilities between Stanley Kubrick, who initiated the project, and Spielberg, who finished it after Kubrick's death. And I still don't think, I don't have the same reverence for it as many do, but the second time I saw that, it really did seem to rattle around in my head a long time afterward, and it didn't seem as much of a clash of sensibilities as just a really ambitious kind of bridging of these two sensibilities. I mean, there's no question that Spielberg is, you'd think a lot of the cornier stuff in AI would have come from Spielberg's time with the project, but a lot of that was actually Kubrick. So people are more complicated than you give them credit for, and certainly Spielberg's got light and dark in him, just like Kubrick had a certain amount of shameless melodrama in him in his way. But AI, you know, I feel like the third time I see AI, like in another few years, then I'll have a truer fix on if I really think it's a major Spielberg film or not. But I do love the character of Gigolo Joe just because we've seen that sort of not quite alien, not quite robot, not quite human character. As recently as Michael Fassbender doing a variation on this, right, in Ridley Scott's Prometheus, which is it's a familiar conceit. We've seen this type of character before, and when you get the right actor in there doing it, it is made new.
I can absolutely see that. Yeah, Prometheus didn't quite occur to me. But, it probably wouldn't have made my top five because when I was putting this list together, I was specifically aiming for films that I really love and respect for themselves, not just for the futuristic jobs. And that film, as much as I liked aspects of it, particularly Fassbender's performance, particularly the visuals, it's pretty flawed. And I don't think I could put it up there on the top five. But I ended up with a lot of also-rans and honorable mentions. But let's start with yours. What didn't quite make your list?
Well, I mean, it's hard to bend it into the kind of top five movie jobs of the future. But one film I'm not ambivalent about at all is Chris Marker's La Jetée, which is a great, great film from Chris Marker. And it was made in 1962. If you haven't seen it, this 28-minute black and white short film from Chris Marker, you must see it. And you describe it, Tasha, and it sounds like kind of the usual time travel science fiction premise. You have it begins in early 1960s Paris at the Orly Airport. You have a boy spying this beautiful woman on an open-air walkway, and then he witnesses the murder of a man by an unknown assailant. And then we realize this is all happening in the past. It is a memory. And years after that incident, nuclear warfare has wiped out humanity. Everybody's gone, of course, where? Underground, as they always do, where government scientists are conducting time travel experiments and that are somehow fueled by this man's enduring memory of what happened at that airport years before. He travels backwards in time. He meets this woman. They fall in love. And all this is happening in 28 minutes. It's an incredibly expansive, beautiful, soulful piece. It's all shot as a series of still photographs, with one minor and striking exception where you get actual 24 frames per second film. And if some of this sounds familiar, it's actually the same setup, the same narrative plot as Terry Gilliam's film 12 Monkeys, made in 1995. Not a film I love, but God knows it's certainly different from the kind of contemplative mood that Marker set up with this maniacal Terry Gilliam pace and everything. But I guess what's the movie job? I guess one of the government scientists trying to save the world somehow by prodding this man's memories of what happened all those years ago. But I love La Jetée. I love
it. Sort of time travel future fixer, which I mean maybe a little more so in 12 Monkeys, but you know, 12 Monkeys has a lot more space and does what it does, I think, a lot more sloppily.
So what about your runners up?
There are a ton more. Archivist of the World's Greenery in Silent Running, hunting down escapees in THX 1138, Handmaid in Handmaid's Tale, Dream Miners in Paprika. I don't even know how you would describe this, but I guess euthanasist in Soylent Green, part-time DNA donor in Gattaca. There's so many. There's so many that could have made the list.
It's funny, you know, there's really not much of a functioning economy in most of these dystopian movies, but when you stack them up that way, it sounds like really the employment opportunities are terrific in the future.
In Soylent Green, the employment opportunities are not all that terrific, quite frankly. But yeah, there are a lot of films out there. I eventually went with the five that I thought were strongest, both as films and as having jobs that don't exist in any form today.
Excellent. You can send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave a voicemail at 312-264-0744 or find the show on Twitter at Filmspotting or at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Opening in wide release this weekend, The Big Wedding, which is a remake of a 2006 French film about a long-divorced couple, Robert De Niro and Diane Keaton, pretending that they're still married for their adopted son's wedding. You have Pain and Gain, Michael Bay directing Mark Wahlberg and Dwayne The Rock. Is he really called Dwayne The Rock Johnson anymore? I think it's like
he's
formally The Rock.
He's been trying to shed The Rock
Yeah,
for
The
years.
Rock. Just Mr. Johnson in a story about bodybuilders, a true story. True-ish story about bodybuilders in Florida who get caught up in an extortion ring. Things explode. There is a I can verify, Tasha, that there is a shot in Pain and Gain where the three stars, Mark Wahlberg, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and Anthony Mackie are walking in slow motion away from a fireball. It's true.
I really hope that they don't turn around to see how it looks.
You don't need to. You don't need to. It's blow. It's, you know, they don't need to look. Why turn around?
They've seen things blow up. They know what
you're
it looks
good.
Like.
That's right. Opening in limited release here in Chicago this weekend. You have The Angels Share, directed by Ken Loach. We have Mud from director Jeff Nichols, and it's his follow-up to Take Shelter from 2 years ago with Matthew McConaughey. It's a good film. I saw that in the Cannes Film Festival last May. And you have Eddie the Sleepwalking Cannibal. You have Renoir. And a film I like very much that was actually playing at Ebertfest, Tasha, Blancanieves. I think that's the correct pronunciation. Blancanieves, Pablo Berger's film from Spain. It's a twist on the Snow White fairy tale, as originally told by the Brothers Grimm. And it's set in Andalusia, 1920s Spain. It's an homage to 1920s European silent films. And I think it's better than The Artist by far, in fact, in terms of stylistically evoking certain silent film techniques and flourishes that really, in this case, support and enliven this really, really imaginative retelling of the Snow White tale. So check that out, please. Please, Tasha, check it out.
You know what I'm going to suggest that you check out? Also opening in limited release is Graceland. It's film Ron Morales put together this action thriller. I saw it when it opened at Tribeca last year, as a matter of fact. It's currently on iTunes and video on demand, but it actually makes it to theaters in limited release on April 26th. It's sort of a take on High and Low, the Kurosawa film, which he wasn't aware of when he made it, but it's the story of a morally compromised chauffeur who is working for an extremely corrupt politician. And when kidnappers pick up the chauffeur's daughter, thinking that they've got the politician's daughter, the chauffeur ends up in a position of having to essentially deceive his boss into thinking that the boss's daughter has been taken. It's a ringing accusation against essentially politicians and anybody involved in the prostitution trade in the Philippines. It's a film about moral corruption and moral compromise and essentially how just systemic moral lapses in the Philippines become problematic for everyone involved, how they destroy lives, how they destroy relationships, and how they destroy hope for the future. It's fairly grim, but it is such an exciting, such a beautifully shot, and above all, such a beautifully acted story. It's really breathtaking.
Excellent.
I highly recommend
it. Good. Can't wait to see it. Next week, Adam and Josh return with reviews of Mud and Shane Carruth's Upstream Color, plus their summer 2013 movie preview.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Sean O'Coin at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week was from The Man Who Fell to Earth, music of David Bowie, whose new album is The Next Day. You can learn more at davidbowie.com.
Okay, Tasha, so all show here, you've been sort of alluding to this. I'm no longer a member of the AV Club staff as of this taping. What's going on?
Oh, as of this taping, I actually am still in my last week at the AV Club, but at the point where listeners are actually hearing this, I will have finished my last day. I am moving on to a new opportunity, which I can't talk about yet, but I think it's going to be really, really exciting for film fans and fans of this podcast in specific.
Talk about it. I demand it. Why are you being so coy?
I have an NDA that says coy all over it.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, it's something I can't talk about just yet, but believe me, the second we're allowed to talk about it, I'll be all over it.
You'll just interrupt Adam and Josh and say, hey, I got news.
I'm going to call in every 5 minutes until they let me on the
air. So meantime, where can people catch more of your shtuff?
Well, in the meantime, people can find 15 years of my writing at avclub.com, and they can follow me on Twitter if they want to know more about The Next Step at Tasha Robinson at Twitter.
All right.
What about you? Where can people find you?
ChicagoTribune.com/movies. I'm also at on Twitter, Phillips Tribune. And, you know, I walk around muttering downtown. So there you go. That's my resume.
Maybe one of these days we'll bump into each other and mutter at each other downtown.
All right. All right. Well, thanks. It was fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Always a pleasure. For Film Spotting, I'm Tasha Robinson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. Thank you for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Check. Yeah, okay. Mine's working.
Yes. Mine's
working. You sound good, Dave.
Mine sound good, yeah.
All right.
I'm tuning up our microphones, right?
Yeah, tuning up the microphones. Check. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. You said that?
Yes. Check. 1. Check. 1. Check. Okay, that's fine. I give up.
Great.
90.
All right, are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Okay, from St. Paul, Minnesota. This is The Conversation with Daddy Van Halgren. My guest, as always,
David Halgren.
And today on The Conversation, Film Spotting, we'll be talking about the Marx Brothers classic movie, A Night at the Opera. That was our movie that we watched on movie night Friday. So let's start it off. I'll try to give a brief description of A Night at the Opera. Actually, you might want to do it because there's a long way to do it because it's a very complicated plot. Or there's a short way to do it. I'll start, you finish. Ready? So it's the Marx Brothers. It's Night at the Opera. It's 1935, directed by Sam Wood. You've got Groucho, Harpo, and
Marco.
Okay, or Marco or Chico. And so you've got the Marx Brothers. They get behind the scenes of an opera called Il Trovatore, and all hell breaks loose. What'd you think?
Good. How many stars did you do?
I think I'd probably give it maybe 4.
I'd give it 10 stars.
All right, 10 stars for A Night at the Opera. What were some of the things you liked about it?
Because this police are chasing them, and this guy who talks a lot, what's his name?
Harpo. I'm sorry, the guy that talks a lot, Groucho.
Groucho got fired. So Marco, the guy who...
Chico, yeah.
Chico, who talked a lot.
Oh, Groucho, yep.
Groucho. He got fired, and he could walk down this big case of stairs, so somebody helped him by kicking him.
That's right.
Downstairs, and he was like rolling.
That's right. He rolled all the way down the stairs.
Yeah.
Like on his way up, he took the elevator. On his way down, he was kicked down the stairs.
Yeah.
Rough. That was a tough moment for Groucho. Yeah. So again, 4 stars for me, 10 stars for Dave. That's Night at the Opera. And we can definitely recommend it for 4 and up. Wouldn't you say?
5 and up.
Oh, five, is it 5 and up? 5 and up.
4 and up. Fine.
If you're almost 5, probably okay.
Fine. If you're 4, fine.
Fine. Watch it.
Okay. Yes, watch it.